Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Motherhood, Martyrdom, and Costco Runs by Whitney Dineen. Narrated by Lila Winters. Introduction. This book is titled Motherhood, Martyrdom, and Costco Runs for one obvious reason. If you happen to be a mother of young children, you know your life is either spent hanging on the cross of said motherhood or running your entire brood to Costco for more toilet paper. It's who we are. Many of the moms from my childhood were the stay-at-home variety. These ladies gave up a lot of personal and professional desires to be Johnny on the spot for the home front. They scheduled everything from doctor's appointments to music lessons to extracurricular activities. They made sure the wash was done, the house was clean, and meals were put on the table. My mom found ways to express herself and cultivate her interests within the confines of her role as the CEO of our family. She wrote an article for a local Chicago paper and taught gourmet cooking classes. She did yoga with her friends and ran the hospital auxiliary. She also entertained on a grand scale and kept a big garden. She was one busy lady. Today, most households require two incomes to function properly. We're scrambling in a million different directions trying to get everyone everywhere they need to be, and still the laundry needs to get done, the house needs to be cleaned, groceries have to be purchased, and then there's basic yard maintenance so your neighbors don't rat you out to the homeowners association for neglected weeds and an unruly lawn. And darn if your kids don't expect you to feed them every day. Add making a living and the full social and academic calendars of children, and what do you have? The answer is very tired parents. I'm not saying parenthood was easier for my folks. Having children, no matter the generation, is full of highs and lows, stress, and worry. Kids are a gigantic, wonderful, exhausting, excruciating endeavor, and they are worth every harrowing second of the journey. This is a book about my roller coaster ride into middle-aged motherhood. There are self-pitying tales of dirty clothes and dishes, sleepless nights and bad hair. I regularly nail myself to the martyrdom cross and occasionally come down and get real. I laugh at my kids, and I love them. I share the good, the bad, and the ugly. I also go to Costco. A lot. These vignettes are all relatively quick listens, as I know you're most likely enjoying them on the toilet or in the 3.5 minutes you can still focus at the end of the day. I figure if you block out 5 minutes a day, you can have this book finished in a month. Hopefully at the end, you'll have had some laughs, perhaps a couple of tears, and an eye roll or two. I'm guessing you'll also feel a lot better about yourself as a mother, because the truth is, no one makes motherhood look harder than I do. It's all relative. I used to think I'd have all the children I was going to have by the time I was 30. Then 30 hit, and I didn't have any, so I adjusted my deadline to 40. By the time I was 37, I was having miscarriages every 10 to 12 months. That's when my deadline turned into more of a plea. It went something like, "Dear God, please let me hatch out one or two of these eggs successfully before they're all hard-boiled. Please." Then the negotiating started. "God, if you let me have kids, I'll be less vain. I'll donate 80% of everything I own to charity. I'll give up French fries for life." We all know I couldn't possibly hold up my end of this deal, especially the French fry thing, but I was desperate enough to mean it at the time. I never wanted to be an old mother. I wanted to be a young, cool, hip mom that all the kids wanted to hang with. They'd clamor to me like barnacles on a boat just to learn the secret of my awesomeness. They'd bask in my magnificence like Oregonians on the first sunny day after a long winter's rain. Ultimately, two things made my dream unattainable. One, I've never been cool. I've acted and dressed like a 40-year-old since I was 15. Young, I could be, but hip was never in the cards. Number two, I had my first live birth at 40. You know, the age some are experiencing, a rapidly emptying nest, freedom to travel the world, and large enough bank accounts, investment portfolios, IRAs, to buy Porsches and other sundry toys they've always longed for. Aside from not being perceived as the cool parent, my other concern about old motherhood was how I'd cope as the geriatric crone in a pack of young hens. Would I be able to find friends? Would the cool moms shut me out like a freak pledging the wrong sorority? Would they keep forgetting I was my child's mother and not her grandmother? It turns out my fears were for naught. Apparently, age has very little to do with how we deal with motherhood. My mom friends range in age from 32 to 52, and here's the fundamental truth about all of us. We're all overwhelmed, we're all tired, we all scream at our kids, and we all dream of a clean house. Here's the difference. Some of the young moms actually leave their domiciles looking like they've brushed their hair and teeth. Some even wear clean clothes. Some have the energy and desire to fit into their pre-baby jeans and go to yoga regularly in their delightfully patterned LuLaRoe leggings. Conversely, the 48-year-old mother of two young grade schoolers will often wake up, look down at the faded Old Navy yoga pants she slept in, and deem them clean enough for another day. She'll use coffee to mask her morning breath, and somehow putting on makeup will devolve into making sure the most noticeable chin hairs get plucked. Yes, she will occasionally fall into downward dog, but that mostly has to do with tipping over and not actual yoga. Two of my older daughters' BFFs have moms that are the same age as me, and I find this enormously comforting. We're drawn to each other at school functions and are gladdened by the knowledge there's another in the room old enough to know who Edith Bunker is. Sometimes we'll throw out band names like Devo or Depeche Mode for the same reason. After all, actually being 16 when 16 Candles came out is way different than watching it only after it had earned retro cult classic status. I guess what I'm really trying to say is this. The age you are when you become a mother is irrelevant. There will always be younger, cooler, hipper, thinner women than you. But you can bet your butt if these women also happen to be mothers, they're just as tired and frustrated as you are. It's all relative. Meanwhile, somewhere back in the colonies, imagine accidentally slipping through a crack in the space-time continuum and falling smack into colonial America, sometime circa the American Revolution. Now envision yourself walking down a picturesque tree-lined brick street and strolling into a quaint little mercantile. The offerings are unimaginably modest by our modern-day standards, but no one seems to notice. Our forefathers' mothers are bustling around purchasing necessities like tea, sugar, and muslin. You with me? Okay, now imagine striking up a conversation with someone. You know, hey there, how's it going? Seen any redcoats in the area lately? That kind of thing. Once you've established a thread of camaraderie, I want you to try to explain Costco to this person. I'm just going to pause to give you a moment to try to conjure such an insane vision. If it were me, I think I'd start with, "You should see what the stores look like where I come from. We have this one called Costco that's about 10,000 times the size of this store. I mean, it's huge." Then I'd launch into all the crazy stuff you can buy at Costco. "They don't sell fabric because the clothes are already made, and they're available in every size you can imagine. They even sell shoes, socks, and unmentionables. And the books. So many books." I'd steer clear of talking about the photo and computer departments, lest they hang me for witchcraft. But I'd make sure to venture into all the glassware, bakeware, and dish selections. Not to mention the assortment of fruits, vegetables, bakery items, and jewelry. Then I'd hit them with, "They sell hundreds of chickens already killed, plucked, roasted, and ready to eat." I'd regale them with tales of their succulents. "They're the most tender and juicy birds you've ever put in your mouth. Did I mention they were already dead? I'd expound upon the wonders of the dairy department and the insane cheese assortment. I'm pretty sure the baking aisle would leave them swooning like debutantes at their coming-out balls. Sugar and flour in 25-pound bags, chocolate chips, cocoa, and spices. The hardest part would be keeping the wall of toilet paper to myself. I mean, how in the world would a denizen of colonial America ever begin to imagine the wonders of toilet paper, yet alone an entire wall of the stuff? I'd expound upon the nuts next. They have every kind of nut you can imagine. Pine nuts, peanuts, walnuts, almonds, pecans, pistachio, macadamia nuts, and cashews. And they're already shelled, roasted, and salted, and some are even covered in chocolate. I'd gush. There's no way to describe Costco without mentioning the samples. They sell food from all over the world and give you samples of it in almost every aisle you walk down, free. Then I'd wax poetic about all the wonderful medicines and supplements available. I'd touch on the luxurious toiletries and hygiene products. When they were near to unconscious from the effort of trying to grasp such an Eden, I'd hit them with the food court. They have slices of pizza as big as your head, and the most decadent ice cream bars that have been dipped in melted chocolate and rolled in chopped nuts. There are machines that dispense every kind of drink you'd ever want. Don't get me started on the churros and soft-serve frozen yogurt. Not that they'd know what any of these foods are. I don't recall ever hearing the colonials were known for their za or soft-serve. On and on I'd go until they'd either arrest me for heresy or lock me up for lunacy, although I usually pull myself out of this reverie before coming to any real harm, mostly because I'm craving a frozen yogurt and have a burning hot desire to add another 168 rolls of toilet paper to my growing stash. Time for a Costco run. I walked barefoot in the snow. We didn't even have stickers when I was your age. Do you hear me? No stickers. I beseech my young daughters to grasp how incredibly fortunate they are to live in such a gluttonous, loot-filled age. The fact that they have drawers full of stickers they don't properly revere is beyond me. I would have weeded the entire garden for the whole summer and given up my meager allowance for a year just to have a tenth of what they take for granted as their due. What do you mean you didn't have stickers? My 7-year-old demands. You mean stickers weren't invented yet, or you just didn't have any? I mean, I say, trying to slow down my rapidly accelerating heart rate, stickers were a thing only teachers had, and they used them sparingly. Stickers were not available for children to buy. Do you hear me? No stickers. My daughters stare at me like I'm saying the world was in black and white when I grew up. They have absolutely no barometer for a world devoid of stickers. My 5-year-old starts to speak very slowly, as though any false movement might launch me into space like a bottle rocket. Mommy, she enunciates carefully, why didn't you just drive to the dollar store and buy stickers? Why didn't I just drive to the dollar store? Because, and I pause for dramatic effect here, we didn't have dollar stores when I was a kid. Do you hear that? No stickers and no dollar stores. It's like I'm telling them I'm from Mars or that I breathe through my toes. Like I'm sharing I grew up in a land that didn't have sunshine or French fries. They simply do not know what to make of this confession. After what feels like eons of mentally dissecting me with their adorable big brown eyes and tilted heads, my 7-year-old comes over and throws her arms around me and consoles, "Oh, Mommy, that must have been so hard for you. I'm so sorry." Wait, what just happened here? I'm not bemoaning the lack of stickers in my formative years. I'm simply trying to get them to grasp how very lucky they are to have so much. So I try a new tactic. We didn't have home computers when I was your age. The 5-year-old begs to know, How did you print out coloring pages? How in the world do I begin to explain the 70s and 80s to these children? Their lives are so full of advantage and stuff they can't begin to conceive how great life was when things were a little harder to come by. I'm determined to make them appreciate the bounty in which they live. So I try again. You know how you have an iPad with all those great apps on it? Then I enumerate some, just in case they've forgotten. There are Barbie makeover apps, baking apps, cake decorating apps, and the honeybee game. Two little heads nod up and down, so I continue. We had one electronic game. One. It plugged into our TV, and the whole thing was two lines hitting a little electronic ball back and forth across the screen. Seven asks, what was the point of that? Five inquires, did it sing songs or flash bright colors? Did it bake anything? No, it did nothing but knock a little ball back and forth across the screen. Well, actually, it beeped every time it hit the ball, so it did that too. Again, with the big brown eyes and tilting heads. Why in the world would you want to play a game like that? They demand to know. We played it for hours. We loved it. It was advanced technology in the 70s. Pong was the most amazing game ever. I can't believe I'm even saying that. I scoff at Pong, but I'm trying to put this into some perspective for my kids. I know I'm moments away from telling them I walked to school barefoot in the snow uphill both ways with boulders on my shoulders. And that's when it hits me. I already have. A lack of stickers and Pong are my generation's barefoot in the snow. All of a sudden, I feel a great kinship with my parents. I also feel very old. Finding the balance. I've long struggled to find balance in my life, and the struggle is real, folks. According to my calculations, I need a minimum of 36 hours in a day and approximately 9.7 days in a week to accomplish everything necessary for optimal equilibrium. In order to be the mom, wife, daughter, writer, and friend I aspire to be, I'd need two clones, a cleaning lady, and a cook. In short, I'm screwed. I have friends who assure me that taking care of myself first is the key to successful balance. If you do too much for others and don't do for yourself, you'll wither on the vine, or some equally inane nonsense. I'm torn between wanting to hug them for their astonishing naivete and smacking them senseless for wasting even a second of my life with such stupid drivel. Me time is something that was snatched from my grasp by wide-awake infants in the middle of the night, by norovirus spewed on freshly painted walls, and by constant butt wipings during the potty training years. I'm pretty sure me time is a mythical entity right up there with unicorns and fairies. I was so sure when both of my girls hit full-day school, I would have my life back. I would have the elusive me time we wax on about. My house would always be clean. I would write three times as many books, and everyone in my sphere would feel the full force of my presence. What a load of horsehooey. Both girls have been in full-day school since September, and I am no more productive for it. That's not entirely true. I actually go to the gym three mornings a week now and feel marginally healthier, less snatchy, so that's a good thing. The house is cleaner, but only because the mess makers aren't in constant whirl, and I occasionally get to talk to an old friend on the phone. But sadly, I'm still buried under the weight of my to-do list. How am I ever going to find the balance I crave? One friend suggested hot yoga as the cure-all. She's currently in traction, or would be if I had any telekinetic powers. I'm 48. I'm as hot as I ever want to be again this side of a boiling pit of lava. Her suggestion is right up there with proposing the key to world peace is through regular mani-pedis, or perhaps group hugs. Can you just see the start of every UN powwow, starting with Downward Dog in a 98-degree room, followed by OPI's I'm Not Really a Waitress painted on everyone's toes? Ludicrous. I just returned home from a very informative writers' conference and couldn't wait to get back and start implementing all the marvelous new techniques I learned about. I learned that even if I have to force productivity, I have to be productive, that organization and involvement in social media can make or break me. I learned the faster I publish my books, the more momentum my career will have. Essentially, I learned that I will never be the huge success I dream of being if I don't give my career 200% every single day. I dwell on that when I'm making my littles their breakfast and packing their lunches. I worry about it when I pick them up from school and take them to the bounce house instead of coming home so I can go back to work. And when we're cuddled up in my bed at night watching the next Food Network star, I finally realize, who cares? My girls don't care if I'm a household name or not. They don't care if all the laundry is perfectly folded in their drawers. They don't even care if my gray roots are dyed in a timely fashion. All they care about is that I'm present with them, actively participating in their lives. In a ditch effort to save my sanity, I've decided to prioritize the various compartments of my world. My children come first. My husband is somewhere near the top of the list, but I often say to him, "Remember those 20 years we had together before having kids? Cling to the memories." I don't even know what to say to my parents except, "Man, did I take you guys for granted." And then comes work, laundry, vacuuming, shopping for groceries, etc. I've come to the conclusion that balance is probably not something I will ever attain in a single period in my life. The hope is that at the end of my journey, I'll realize it was something that developed along the way. I envision sitting under a big oak tree with a good book, an afghan, and a mocha, somewhere in the distant future, with a smile on my wrinkled face, reminiscing, "I've had a clean house, I've had wonderful times with friends, and I've written a lot of good stories along the way. But more importantly, I raised two kind and compassionate children who helped make the world a better place. I've had a successful and loving marriage, and I was a good daughter. As a whole, I balanced a lot and did a pretty darn good job of it. For now, though, I'm a hectic mess, just taking it one day at a time." I swear. I love to swear. Some righteous, judgmental twits will tell you swearing is a sign of a limited vocabulary or lack of intellect. They're wrong. Swearing is a marvelously freeing way to release the pressures of life. It's like working out with all of the sweat and effort. It's genius. Here's the thing, though. As much as I love to let loose an array of vulgarities salty enough to leave the preacher's wife gasping for breath, I was forced to give it up. When I was pregnant with my older daughter, once it looked like the pregnancy was a go, my husband approached me and lovingly suggested I quit expressing myself like a sailor on shore leave. I countered that I would give it up before our daughter started talking. He protested my timeline, stating there was no way I could go from my daily quota of filth to nothing, cold turkey. He was convinced I needed to cease immediately, so it would be fully out of my system before our child arrived on the planet. I wanted to tell him he was wrong. I could stop anytime I wanted to. It's not like I was an addict. "I can hear your eyes rolling. Yes, I know the addict is always the last to know. But it's not like I was addicted to drugs, alcohol, or ho-hos. I was addicted to expression. How can that be wrong?" I offered to institute a swear jar and promised to happily pay every time an expletive left my lips. My husband's response was, "Bankruptcy is not the answer. Not swearing is the answer." Well, if that attitude didn't just make me want to let rip a stream of vitriolic bile, I don't know what did. And please note, people capable of correctly using the word vitriolic in context are, in fact, not stupid. Take that, you judgmental harpies. I'm a logophile. I love words, all words, especially juicy creative ones that some find offensive. I went into a bit of a funk as I cleaned up my act. I felt less inspired with my new streamlined vocabulary. I was lonely. My husband could not believe I was having such a hard time letting go. Occasionally, I'd snap and scream, "What in the fudge do you want from me? This shoot is hard to forget. I love to goose down swear. I love it. Do you hear me?" Of course, I didn't really say fudge, shoot, or goose down, but I'm sure you guessed that already. After another child and many months of not being able to fully wean myself, my husband and I came to an agreement. I could not swear while the children were conscious. That seemed like a compromise I could work with. All I had to do was make it through the day, depositing my invectives into an imaginary account as I went. Then, when the kids went to sleep, I could set them free onto the world. Deal. We shook on it. My children are now 5 and 7, and the worst word they've ever heard me say is hell. And I didn't even pull that one out until last year. I amaze myself. Granted, most adults who know me have heard me say much worse, but the precious beings placed in my care to raise and nurture have no idea the kind of verbal exchange I'm capable of. And as hard as it is for me to admit, I think that's probably for the best. You have to go potty now? Potty training at Costco is a nightmare, a full-blown mare of the night. It would test the patience of a saint. Truthfully, Mother Teresa would have been all, "Fudge this chute, go in your pants." I tried that approach again and again, but you know what? Toddlers who are potty training don't want to go in their pants. They've got it in their little heads that pottying in their pants is counterproductive to the whole potty training concept. Grr. And the thing with Costco bathrooms is they're always 3.5 football fields away from where you're shopping. Always. So what do? You run like the rabid hounds of hell are nipping at your heels to get your little trainer on a potty stat. Does this always work? No. No, it does not. Sometimes your little one only has the strength to hold it for 2 football fields. Luckily, this usually isn't a problem if they're wearing training pants. Yet once they've reached the point where they refuse to wear training pants, then it's a horse of a different color. It now means finding someone to mop up the mess, dragging your disappointed and sobbing children into the bathroom to clean them up, and then returning to your shopping, damp and slightly odoriferous from your recent excursion. I managed to shop at Costco and get not only 1, but 2 children potty trained. It was the longest 20 years of my life. Even once both girls were fully toilet trained, they still had an otherworldly obsession for the Costco bathroom. We averaged 3 visits every single trip. Once when we first got there, once during the middle of shopping, and then again right before we left. The thing is, they didn't always go to the bathroom while they were in there, but they always, always yodeled. My 2 and 4-year-old daughters had discovered the perfect acoustics for their newfound love of the sound of music. Sometimes they tinkled first before launching into their glass-shattering version of the Lonely Goat Herd, and sometimes they started the very nanosecond they set foot over the threshold. But either way, yodeling was on the menu. It's impossible not to be slightly mortified when your tone-deaf daughters discover a love for the yodel, but it's funny nonetheless. It's even funnier when old women in the stalls next to them encourage them by stamping their feet and clapping their hands along with the unexpected serenade. Yodeling was not the only pastime my girls had in the bathroom at Costco. Heaven forbid someone was in there doing a number 2. My little darlings would convulse in fits of gagging and coughing spasms. They'd sputter as if gasping for their last breath on earth. "Oh, Mommy, I'm going to be sick!" Insert very realistic retching noises here. "That's the worst stink in the world!"
Sample complete. Ready to continue?